So, what have we done in this first day of our exploration of stillness and movement? We have experienced movement in walking and sitting. We use the breath as our means of knowing it in sitting, and then the activity of the walking process, and then somewhat of the use of eyes and hands, tactile feelings of movement. We've also known stillness, stillness in walking when we would stop at the end of our walk and when we would interrupt in the middle. So we have proven to ourselves that we can deliberately, in a laboratory way of eipasako, come see for yourself, as the Buddha invites us to do, that we can know as direct experience this choice of movement or stillness, and that we can choose to make them as objects, as in and of themselves, not just as a getting somewhere for something else. But we can make movement itself our object. And without, we're not staying with the breath exactly. We're knowing movement. And same with stillness. We've also seen that we can use the earth element for knowing stillness. It lends itself to that. And the breath as a manifestation of wind element lends itself to movement. So therefore, we have a basis for going on in our exploration on this retreat, but those of you who are leaving, for going on with the exploration in your own experience. We've also started to see how that there is movement. Once movement gets started, there's an inclination for movement to keep on going, and that the mind can get very tied up in movement. And so there's both mind reasons and body reasons that movement has a certain momentum factor, let's call it. And that can also be habitual. So in our mind, but we needed to learn to plan, but now we are like addicted to planning, or it's so habitual, we don't even necessarily need it, but that's what it does all the time. And so we keep on doing that. So we're starting to see the way we are consciously and unconsciously relating to both movement and stillness. And we're at the beginning of this exploration. And we've witnessed for ourselves that we can direct our attention towards movement and sustain it on movement, or we can direct and sustain on stillness. So therefore, there's something here. And we've seen that a movement and stillness and movement seem to have, I would suggest, that there is a complementariness to it, even as there are contrast. So stillness and movement are different, right? But that difference being, if we call them opposites, that the opposites complementary in that one needs the other. This is going to be a little heady here for a few minutes. But they need each other. And so stillness, which we don't recognize as much, is somehow really intricately part of all of our experience of the brain, of the heart, of intuition, that the stillness is right there. So this opposite, stillness and movement, is part of the opposites that the Buddha refers to in terms of the eight worldly winds: gain, loss, pain, pleasure, fame, blame, and praise and ill repute. Stillness and movement are worldly. They are, by worldly, I mean secular. I mean, they are the nature of this realm. The nature of nature in this realm involves stillness and movement. It's the nature of this. And we know movement more than we know stillness. Although in Buddhism, there's, of course, with the idea of serenity, with the idea of concentration, that samadhi, jhana states, these emphases on things that have stillness in them quite a bit. And yet, in terms of understanding suffering, it's watching the movement that is presented primarily in the first and second noble truths, and then in the fourth noble truth, it's the movement. And in the third noble truth, it's the refinement of the mind's relationship to movement that really starts to bring about these changes, these liberations. I'll come back more to that in another time. So something's being pointed out here, not pointed out just by me in this instance, but being pointed out, period. Ajahn Chah have more notes than I know what to do with. Ajahn Chah, this is from Anallio's book, the Small Boat, Great Mountain. He says, Ajahn Chah would put the question, where do you go for a few months? As they got used to that, he would switch questions. Throughout his career, he posed a number of different questions. The very last question he came up with before his health deteriorated were in the form of a little series. And we're going to do this together. So we were all listening to Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah says, have you ever seen still water? The monks would nod. Yes, of course we've seen still water before. At the same time, they were probably saying inwardly, now that's a pretty strange question. But outwardly, everyone was very respectful to Ajahn Chah, as he was one of Thailand's great meditation masters. Then he would say, well, then, have you ever seen flowing water? And that seemed a strange thing to ask also. They'd respond, yes, we've seen flowing water. He would then ask, so did you ever see still flowing water? No, that we've never seen. He loved to get that bewildered effect. Ajahn Chah would then explain that the mind's nature is still. Hear this, that the mind's nature is still. That is certainly my own experience. And this is one of the things in these 3 days that I, as best I'm able, I'm going to deliver you your own experience of that as best I'm able. Ajahn Chah would then explain that the mind's nature is still, yet it's flowing. And that's where it gets into some subtle levels that are so mysterious. It's still, but it's floating. The mind is still, but it's floating. He would use the word citta for the knowing mind, the mind of awareness. The citta itself is totally still. It has no movement. It is not related to all that arises and ceases. It's not related to all that arises and ceases. That capacity is not related to the things that we know that are arising and ceasing. Not related. It's different than that. Mind, objects, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, thoughts, and emotions flow through it. Problems arise because the clarity of the mind gets entangled with sense impressions. The untrained heart chases the delightful, runs away from the painful, and as a result, finds itself struggling, alienated, and miserable. By contemplating our own experience, we can make a clear distinction between the mind that knows, citta, And the sense impressions are what I would call sense objects, mind objects, that flow through it. By refusing to get entangled with any sense impression, we find refuge in that quality of stillness, silence, and spaciousness, which is the mind's own nature. This policy of non-interference allows everything and is disturbed by nothing. So we're looking for little taste or foretaste or foreshadowings of this stillness and movement in this manner. It is a birthright. It's there in, I think, every religion that I'm aware of in some way, this recognition of stillness and movement, sometimes unconsciously, and particularly in First Peoples religious ceremonies. They definitely utilize both, but don't necessarily name it, as I've been exposed to those. So what is going on? What is going on? This is from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, which you know I'm very partial to, and I find his captures the meditative experience, the spiritual quest, very, very well. And this is one of his most well-known lines from all of his work. And it's in the first quartet when he says, "At the still point of the turning world," the world that's always moving, where we're moving to objects and away from objects, "at the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless," so it's the still point is not of this moving world. It's not of it. If the moving world is moving through time, like this on an act, it's just moving. Here's one moment, the next moment, I ask you to notice here and now and in the immediacy of the moment. So there's this flow of moments. And we, if we're going to be present, if we're going to participate, we're participating in it moment by moment. We can arc, you know, over a period of time and work with restless mind or wanting mind or whatever it is, or, you know, get a paper written or get our jobs done, get the groceries packed, whatever it is. But nonetheless, it's moment to moment in the doing. "So at the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards." So there's not movement here. "At the still point, there the dance is." So the still point lies at the center of all the movement, all the moments of our life that's involved in any kind of objects, mind objects arising through any sense gate, touch, smell, hear, see, taste, as always, and can be experienced, believe it or not. We can experience the stillness in that moment. We can experience the stillness in that moment. So we can walk around with access to the stillness as we're moving and through our day and all of these different mind object experiences from all these different sense gates. "At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is, but neither arrest nor movement, and do not call it fixity." That's so important. That happens a lot. People get the wrong idea right there. "And do not call it fixity, for past and future are gathered." So past and future are gathered. "Neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance." So we're going to stop with that right now. Later on, I'll take those next few lines, but not today. So there we are. there we are in this relationship to our objects of experience as human beings. Human beings where? In a world where opposites predominate. We like or don't like. It's pleasant or it's unpleasant. We are afraid or not afraid. We live in a world of opposites. So our experience varies so much if we are living the ups and downs of the like and don't like, the have and not have. We are really without training, we're merely in a reactive state most of the time to these opposites. And you know, and there's gain and loss, you know, that are tremendously difficult gains and losses. There's skillful and unskillful, which we've witnessed so much of, and so painful to watch on a national level. And during this pandemic, all of the unskillful things that were done, and that's not a mistake. This realm is made up of opposites. As far as I can tell, I see no reason to think that this is a mistake. Unless you want to say that this very realm that we live in, this physical world with and all the living creatures in it, are all a mistake and the whole realm's a mistake. Or you could say, oh, well, this is a realm because we got kicked out of Eden. If you wanted to look at it that way, you could, and say, well, see, this is a punishing realm. This is its own kind of hell realm or something like that. Or you could say, oh, but I experience it as not a mistake. And when I am caught in the opposites, that's not because I'm a terrible person. It's because the opposites are the nature of this realm. And it is only when we're present and understanding and seeing that we have freedom. So the freedom of that's offered in the 12 insights of the Four Noble Truths relate very much in relation to movement and stillness. I made passing reference to that in Dancing with Life, but I didn't go on and on about it because that was not the teaching of the Four Noble Truths that I was stressing at that time. I was stressing the 12 insights. So this is kind of a moment in that way for us, that when we get really interested in this question of stillness and movement, we can have we can look at how we move towards objects and we cling to objects. And we grasp after objects and so forth in terms of the dependent origination teachings of the Buddha. And we can see it as those steps where we take birth and we suffer. That's all movement. Every one of those steps are movement. But we can also see it as just movement. So we can see that there's movement. And recognizing there's movement, we can drop into a wise relationship to movement without having to remember, you know, the 12 insights, the five hindrances, the 10 fetters. We don't have to remember any of that. We know that movement is challenging and we want to have a wise relationship to movement. We can watch our mind moving and just incline the mind skillfully. This would again be part of right effort in the Eightfold Path. And then as we do this, we understand the arbitrary nature of the movement of the mind, and so we don't take it so personally. And the less personal we take it, the more choice we have in this way. And we can get to the point, not all at once, but over a relatively short period of time, that we can experience the flow of reality, just not as a concept, not an applied concept between us and reality, that reality meaning this arising moment, that arising moment, and the knowing of this moment and that moment. But we can experience it as, like Ajahn Chah says, still flowing water. That way of relating to our experience of the dance of the opposites. And that's why Eliot says there is only the dance. In terms of this reality, on that stream, flowing moment, the horizontal line, there's only the dance. One moment changing into another, pleasant arising, unpleasant arising. There's only the dance. A physical sensation arising, passing, a mental thought arising and passing, a mind state arising and passing, just all arising and passing. The awakening factors present, now it's not. It's only the dance. That's why I call it the dance of life, because it is only, there is only the dance. I mean, we could easily prove that to ourselves, find something else in relation to objects that change. It's a little heady here, but it's so practical. My goodness, it's so practical. We're living in a realm that's made up of ever-changing objects through all the sense gates. That's our realm. So, and it's not like, oh, this is a mistake and somehow it's going to be a different realm. No, there's, you know, that belongs to the non-returner and so forth. They live in a different realm. We live in this realm in this moment, whatever you believe about other possible realms. And if we attend to ourselves in this realm, those other possible realms, I suspect, take care of themselves insofar as they exist, because that would be natural, that would be lawful for that to be true. And the Buddha makes great claim about the lawfulness of the way things work, the way it is. So here we are with this question. How do we do this? In part, it's what we identify with. Rilke says, the great poet Rilke, says, "No, my life is not this precipitous hour through which you see me passing at a run." Pretty much captures us, doesn't it? That we're running through life, that there's this, and it's not just when it comes like, oh, I'm busy to doing, but it's like the time goes like this all the time. So if the more present you are, the more you realize how quickly the moment goes. Yeah, you know, like when you start looking at a Nietzsche that way, you're first asked to notice, at least in my day of training, you were first asked to notice the passing of the moment. And because the passing of the moment was so, that's what you really were showing up for anyway. You barely caught the moment before it was gone. And then you were learned to look at the arising of the moment and catch the arising, like the arising of the breath. What's that first moment of an inhale? What's that first moment of the exhale? So that you're really trying to see that, like I was asking you to feel movement and feel stillness. You're trained that way. And then you're learned to see arising and passing. And like with the breath, and the way I was trained, you would see the rising of the inhale, its duration, and its cessation. And that you trained so that you stayed with it the whole time. And so every moment was different because it was either arising just in the breath level. That's a pretty basic level. And then you drop down from there and you see, but every moment is arising and passing. Within that, or the moment of arising, there's all these little moments in there. And the duration, there's lots of little moments. And then in the passing, there's lots of little moments that it's just like, and it kind of breaks us. It can break us open. And in terms of perception, be a little disorienting for some people. So Rilke, "No, my life is not this precipitous hour through which you see me passing at a run. I stand before my background like a tree. Of all my many mouths, I am but one, and that which soonest chooses to be dumb. I am the rest between two notes, which struck together sound discordantly, because death's note would claim a higher key. But in the dark pause, trembling, the notes meet harmonious, and the song continues sweet, and the song continues sweet. So were there not that pause between the two notes, clash, between life and death, there's two notes, between one moment and the next moment, that there's this pause in between. In the Vasudhimagga, not Vasudhimagga, in the, can't think of what it's called right this moment. There's a description of these Bhavanga moments, that there's seven moments, whatever that means, between one thought and another, that there's these points in there where the mind is at rest, that there is the still point is always there, because everything's moving so fast. We don't feel that, because we think everything, we're not, our minds are not subtle enough to feel the real literalness of our experience. You can think of that whatever you want, but the fact is that in terms of walking around mindfulness, you can feel the presence of stillness just as you can feel the presence of movement. So you can have whatever you're experiencing. You can, if you look back, if you step back a little more to the witness and less the participant, you learn to be able to access this feeling of stillness. So in every sound, there is silence. Silence is also present. You can decide for yourself whether or not this is true, if you'll take 6 months or so to see for yourself. You're not necessarily going to see it in the first 10, 20, 100 times that you go looking for it, but in time you will see. And this stillness is where the life is. I am the rest between two notes. That, so another way of looking at this, understanding this, a moment is arising here and then gone. There is a capacity utilized, which we call awareness. I'm going to give you some Pali terms. Anadio, in the quote from Anadio, he was using the word chitta. I'm going to give you a different word that the Longpa Sumedha uses, but not today, but I will do that. And it that capacity of knowing is still. It's still. It's the capacity does not get involved in the objects that regular consciousness utilizes that awareness capacity for. It does not move towards objects. Regular consciousness, including mindfulness most of the time, moves towards objects. We are object-oriented creatures. We just are. We're object-oriented. It can be mental. You could spend a lot of time in your mind rather than in other sense gates, but that's still an object. Objects that arise in the mind are mind objects. Ironically, the relatedness, we have relatedness challenges that are referred to in psychology, you know, that we are object relations is a kind of psychological study. And but it doesn't, as far as I know, include this level of experience, but this is really where it all begins. Everything is an object, because everything arises in the mind is known in the mind. If it doesn't arise in the mind, it's not known. It's just not known. Whether or not it exists or not, you know, you can get into how many angels dance on the head of a pin, And I have my view about that, but it's not relevant. It doesn't matter. Our dance is object related. Where we're dancing, we're responding, we're in relationship to this moment, in this moment. So we're always in relationship. And the Buddhist teachings help us to skillfully be a dance partner, as I described in so much detail in Dance with Life. Because it's as far as I can tell, it's just a practical truth. You know, it's just like, there's a road there or not a road there. It's not some philosophical conceptual thing. It's just the way it is. So then with wanting to understand, then how do I relate to this dance of the opposites? How do I find unity? How do I find wholeness? How do I find a freedom that's not based on ever-changing conditions? And this is what the Buddha teaches us. How to find freedom that's not based on pleasant and unpleasant, that there is a kind of well-being that is not dependent on conditions being pleasant. On other retreats with many of you, we've talked about that in other ways. So I'm not talking about it in other ways these 3 days. I'm pointing us to having our experience of stillness and movement. And the stillness, we're mostly going to discover that when we access through the stillness that exists in the field of perception, that this capacity of perception at this level that's utilized for perceiving any object is separate than any object that's being perceived. And we will see some of the disputes in Buddhism about that, but as to how that's understood. But I don't think there's a great debate about that. That's what happens. That would be my experience, at least. So that's what we're interested in. We're interested in being able to have a kind of participant observer. The observer being the witness, participant, observer, relationship to life, so that we're not just drug around by life. That's not a very good dance partner when your dance partner has to drag you around and you're resisting. You're saying, oh, I'll only go over here. I don't want to go over there. That doesn't work. Or I'm going to go over there no matter what. Uh-huh. Good luck. Good luck. And so this stillness, the very presence of that stillness in our mind that we're accessing, that we start to make that part of every moment's experience more and more, gives us a different experience of the dance because we're including the stillness. We can have big moments of that where these are like liberating moments, but we can have walking around moments all the time of this. And again, we don't have to be special to start to have this. It's natural for us.